All right, I'm here. I'm here. Sorry, I just had to type a thing to a person real quick there. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Welcome back to the show. Today on the show, we're going to have Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online. We're going to have Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute. And we are going, and Forbes, where he writes great stuff. And Jeff Kay from dissenter.firedoglake.com. And O'Neill on Israel and Iraq, Bandow on Iraq, Kay on decades of history, decades of American intervention in Ukraine, and I still have way more invites out than I have time to fill on the show, so I guess we'll see. I was really, really wanting to get... Oh, here's Dar. What's Dar say? Oh, man, you're killing me. Yes, tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. Well, email him at the break. I'm glad he's slammed. That means he's working hard, and that means that we get to enjoy the production process type of thing that he's writing there. And good. Good old Dar Jamail, man. Well, there's a guy who has really put his life on the line to tell you the truth. In the most literal kind of way. Dar Jamail, he'll be on tomorrow. But I also have an invite out to Mitchell Prothero, who I wasn't able to speak to at all last week, who I'm just dying to interview for, I don't know, an hour and a half straight or something. He's in Kurdistan. And you know, I've been getting a lot of email and tweets and a lot of reaction to Mitchell Prothero's interviews. They're like, man, holy crap, this guy's blowing my mind and freaking me out. And, well, it's because he's right. And the stuff that he's describing is a freaking nightmare, and it portends more freaking nightmares to come. That's what it is. He's doing some really good journalism there out of Erbil, Kurdistan. And if I don't get him on today, I'll have him on later in the week, I hope. So cool. Man, so is somebody gonna DM Nouri al-Maliki and kill him today or what? Is there a coup? Is it an American coup? I kind of think there's an American coup. And I believe, and I'm totally making this up, I have no real reason to believe this other than, yeah, I used my imagination, and it seemed like maybe it was right, that when Ban Ki-moon went and visited, that's the Secretary General of the United Nations, that when he went and visited the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, that he was there serving as a messenger for the United States. And I don't really know enough about it, so maybe it's a bad assumption of mine that it's pretty hard for Americans to get an audience with him. That maybe they had to resort to sending the Secretary General just to make sure we're all on the same page. We want rid of this Maliki guy, right? And Sistani has been pretty forthright in saying it's a mistake to try to hold on to power, etc., like that. And I don't know if this is true. This very well could have just been completely made up by the CIA and placed straight into the Washington Times. I don't know. In fact, this is something I wanted to ask Prothero about. But the Washington Times ran a piece that said every other supreme, whatever, highest-ranking Ayatollah in the world has endorsed Sistani and his position. And that's really a big deal because, as Prothero and others have explained on the show, Sistani truly does come from what's called the quietist tradition of Shia Islam that says that his job as a religious leader is to worry about the afterlife and not to participate in domestic politics. The Ayatollah Khamenei ruling Iran right now would be the polar opposite of that view. But that has been how Sistani is, except when it's absolutely necessary. Like in 2004 when he said, oh, you said you were going to give us a democracy. We want one. One man, one vote. Which he might as well have said, unless you want to fight me, George Bush, unless you want to start this war all over again against the supermajority of the country that stood aside and allowed you to get rid of their minority Sunni dictator. He didn't have to say that. Bush understood and backed down. Otherwise, Sistani pretty much stays out of it. Anyway, I think, when Sistani, who is the highest, he's like the Pope, I mean, he doesn't claim to be magic, but he is the highest ranking single leader of all Shiites in the world. And so when he says it's time for you to go, pal, that's pretty much it. What legitimacy does he have? It's pretty much gone. Except the thing of it is that he's got himself a nice little Gestapo that America's built for him. That, you know, as Shane Bauer reported on years ago, as many others have reported on years ago, the Wolf Brigade, the Bada Brigade, special forces that work directly for Maliki. And what happened was yesterday, the president, apparently, he has kind of a ceremonial role, kind of like in Israel. Well, anyway, I'm going to have Eric on. I'm going to try to have Eric on in 10 minutes and explain to you what happened in the parliament. But anyway, it's to Maliki, it amounts to an attempted coup d'etat. And the American State Department wasted no time in coming out and endorsing the whatever action or inaction of the president. Was getting at Maliki here. And Obama, of course, has made no secret whatsoever of the fact that he wants rid of Maliki. But here's the thing. I have a point. I'm getting to it. Not just, geez, they might kill their former sock puppet dictator today, but that there's really a major problem here. And that is that the experts, probably including Chris Hill on MSNBC right now, I couldn't stand the CNN anymore. I had to switch for a week. The experts, and I've seen generals, and I've seen State Department weenies, and I've seen think tankers, and I've seen liberals and conservatives, and I've seen a lot of people who claim to have something to say about Iraq on TV over the last couple of weeks, y'all. And I have to tell you that I don't think any of them are asking the right questions at all. I mean, I'd be a damn fool to say I really know more about it than them when I don't even speak a lick of Arabic. Not one word. Assalamu alaikum, dude. And I probably pronounced all of that wrong. I'm not a Middle East expert, but I am an expert in going, wait a minute. What the hell do you mean that some new prime minister is going to be so nice that the Sunnis take back their declaration of independence and come back under the domination of Shiite-controlled Baghdad as their central government? That is not going to happen at all. And I don't know whether that's actually really the plan or not. I mean, Justin makes the case today that the neocons, at least, have had a real policy of trying to break up Iraq all along. I think most of that is, most of the chaos there has been a failure of policies that aren't really neocon policies. I don't know. Some of them are successes of theirs, too. It's hard to, there's all different people participating in the war. So what was Megan O'Sullivan's real game plan? God knows, right? But the point is that what they've ended up doing is they have completely smashed Iraq. It was a fake country, as Justin says, to begin with. And by invading and going along with Sistani and his demand for one man, one vote, in 2004 and 2005, and letting the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party write the Constitution, and fighting a civil war with the Bada Brigade and the Mahdi Army to cleanse, as they call it. It's politicians who made up that word, of course, to cleanse Baghdad of almost all of their Sunni Arab population. It's about 85% Shiite city now. The natural result of that is that the Sunnis have no power whatsoever. And, of course, most of the oil is up in the north where the Kurds live and in the south where the Shia live. And there is some oil in the Sunni parts, but not very well developed. And so they had a lot to fight for in terms of trying to retain control of Baghdad. But they already lost. They're already on the outs. And the benchmark of 2000, the benchmark of 2007's surge was supposed to be reconciliation. The reason we're putting another 30, 40, 50,000 troops in there is to create enough peace in Baghdad that the parliament can finally get their act together, shake hands, make friends, divvy up the oil spoils in a way where we can hold the country together. Well, they failed to achieve that even then. Hey, I didn't hear the music playing, did you? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. Well, god dang, man. Thank you, James. I just got a real nice email from a guy named James. And thanks to everybody who's donated. I went ahead and I kind of mentioned it a couple times last week, but, well, I had to miss one of the shows last week, and, you know, for reasons, a lot of money I had to spend unplanned, kind of thing. Anyway, I never do a very good job of fundraising when it is fundraising time, but, I'll go ahead and, I'll crib from what I wrote on the blog today, which is, I hate doing this. You know I hate doing this. I don't want to talk about how I need you to give me your money, but I'm in this ridiculous business where I give all of my content away for free. The Liberty Radio Network is great, and they give me a great platform to use here, but it's not a million-dollar business or anything that pays me a salary to do this. I'm laid off from antiwar.com. I still have a very part-time gig there, even though I still work about 60 hours a week. But I make a small fraction of the money that I used to make, which was never much, I promise, working there. But so I don't have a job. This is it. It's this show and these advertisers. And I've got great advertisers, and I appreciate them very much. I need more of them. I'll tell you about them. It's Wall Street Window and The War State. Wall Street Window Investment Advice and The War State Book, both by Michael Swanson, number one best supporter of this show ever since I got laid off from antiwar.com. And thank you very much for that, Mike. Also, then Phil Giraldi and the Council for the National Interest Foundation. They've been helping to support the Future Freedom Foundation, of course. I've got a couple of new sponsors, Darren Marion and Darren's Coffee. Shouldn't matter how you spell it now or Google it if the spelling don't work, but I think he's working on getting the URLs forwarded there. But Darren's Coffee, it's really great, man. And free shipping. Use the promo code Scott. It's $6 worth of shipping, blam, free, if you use the promo code and buy your coffee from Darren's Coffee. So if you like coffee and you drink coffee and you like the show and you like drinking coffee during the show, then, hey, man, why not buy your coffee from Darren's Coffee and use the promo code and let him know that it's worthwhile to sponsor this show, huh? All right, good. And also gold. If you have enough money to donate to this show, then you probably have enough money that you want to save some of it and protect it from the depredations of the inflationists at the American Central Bank. And the way to do that is to buy precious metals. And that's Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., RRBI, like RRBI.com, RRBI, oh, not .com, .co, RRBI.co. And they're really good guys over there. Tim Frey and them do a great job. And they're brokerage dudes. They'll hook you up with gold for sale or any other precious metals that you got. And then, of course, libertystickers.com, my old company that I invented and then sold. Thebumpersticker.com is the printing company for everyone, and libertystickers.com is where my hate-filled rants end up on vinyl. And there's other stuff there, too, you know, that aren't mine. But, I used to be a cab driver. I used to not have a radio show. I used to be the bane of radio hosts. With my cab radio and my cell phone. I used to drive around a lot thinking, no, that's not right at all, god dang it. And then I would think, you know what, I would like to put on a bumper sticker. And then so I started keeping a list on the back of my cab receipts. And I got to the point where I had so many of these damn things, I created a business. And then me and my buddy quickly both sold out to Rick, because he's an actual businessman and knows how to do these things, like run a business. And so Rick McGinnis at thebumpersticker.com has run a great business for now 10 years. For 10 years now. Libertystickers.com and thebumpersticker.com have been kicking ass and making money and creating jobs for the economy and all that stuff, man. Something that obviously I would have ran the company into the ground if it had been up to me to run the company. But I'm glad that I was able to help contribute something to somebody. So anyway, if you got a band, you got a business, you need stickers for any reason, check out thebumpersticker.com. If you wish you could yell and scream how much you hate everything like I get to get away with doing on the show here every day, but you can't because you got a real job and you got to drive to it. Well, at least you can put propaganda on your bumper and let everybody else know how stupid they are. Okay, good. ScottHorton.org/donate. I need money. That's it. I need money. Right now, I got to pay $1,000 to hire a lawyer in California to try to get my old tickets from years ago when I lived in L.A. dismissed so I can get my driver's license unsuspended, so I can get my driver's license instated here, so then maybe, yeah, right, like I'm going to be able to afford this. I got to go and get car insurance again so that then I can get the tax stamps on my goddamn windshield fixed. And every day I'm driving around and I'm seeing cops. I actually live right near a police station too, pretty much. There are cops everywhere. And I'm driving around with, pull me over, my tax stamps are expired, written on my windshield every day. It's completely ridiculous, and it's only going to cost me hundreds and hundreds of more dollars and all that. I mean, and driving on an expired and suspended license, I'm pretty sure that's not good. I don't know what it costs, but it ain't a market rate. It's a government fee. So I got to try to get out ahead of this thing. I got to raise some more money. And you know what? Here's some ad shtick for you. Be like Tom Woods. Donate to the show. I wouldn't have said this, but he just tweeted it out. So he tweeted it out. Tom Woods just signed up for a $100 monthly recurring donation to this show. So if you like Tom Woods and you like liking things that Tom Woods likes and you like supporting things that Tom Woods likes supporting, well, blam, me, the show. And I'm going to show you why here in a minute. We're going to have the great Brendan O'Neill, Doug Bandow, Jeff Kay coming up on the show a little bit later. And then, of course, plenty of Iraq news. I've got Gaza. And as long as I've wasted this whole segment talking about me instead of covering the news for you, let me mention, too, with huge thanks to Ron Paul and the crew at Voices of Liberty. They have now asked me to join up at Voices of Liberty and be a contributor there. And so I'm very happy to be there and to have, you know, my show exposed to their audience and all that. It's very kind of Ron Paul and the rest of the people over there to invite me. And I'm already on there. Just search Voices of Liberty, Scott Horton, and you'll see there's a couple of interviews already posted there. And looking forward to hopefully continuing to do the show so that I can continue contributing to the Voices of Liberty project. I'm down for Ron Paul 1,000,000%. I was just explaining last night on Twitter in a different context, but I'll tell you why I love Ron Paul so much, or I'll tell you the story when I first loved him. I saw Ron Paul in the middle of the night on a rerun on C-SPAN in 1997, his first year back in Congress. And, well, he went back two or three times or whatever, but anyway, went back, elected 96, went back in 97, and there he was, with a sheaf of papers in his hands. Hey, what the? That was weird. Some lady just started talking. Did you guys hear that? And he was saying, Mr. Speaker, I have here in my hand British reports that George H.W. Bush was selling weapons to Saddam Hussein even during Operation Desert Shield. And it said, our Texas at the bottom. And I thought, I like this guy. Republican talking that way about Bush? No way. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, on the line we have our friend Brendan O'Neill. Sorry, Brendan, for screwing this up so bad, but anyway, see if we can get this going. Brendan O'Neill, he is the editor of Spiked Online. That's spiked-online.com there in England. And they got a whole bunch of great writers and great stuff there. And actually, let me ask you first of all a little bit. Could I ask you, and I think we've discussed this in the past, Brendan, but it's been a long time, and I forget and get confused. Could you describe y'all's, you know, more or less, broadly speaking, y'all's political pedigree a little bit? Because you seem to always be against every U.S., U.K., military intervention going back at least through the 90s, really good on everything. And so that means there must be something really wrong with you that makes you that consistent about what's really wrong with the empire.
We refer to ourselves as Marxist libertarians. So we come from a Marxist background. There used to be a magazine called Living Marxism, which is where Spiked comes from. And we are also libertarian, so we support freedom, freedom of speech, freedom in everyday life, the right of people to organize their own affairs free from state intervention. So put those two things together and you have Marxist libertarian.
So like anarcho-communists, kind of?
Yeah, kind of like that, yeah.
Maybe not that far?
Maybe not that kind of zany. More, we're more into reading and thinking and being hopefully quite clever about things. But yeah, we come from a left-wing background, but we are devoted to freedom, as leftists used to be, by the way. So we see ourselves as very traditional, old leftists, kind of 19th century style leftists. Really.
And I think that really explains, too, why you have such this kind of head-on conflict with the humanitarian do-gooder liberal interventionist.
That's right, because they are the opposite of us in many ways. They do not trust people to be able to run their own affairs. They don't think people can survive without external intervention, you know, especially stupid people in Africa and Asia. And they want to send militaries or NGOs or other Western institutions to prop up people's lives, to build states on behalf of people, and basically to look after people in a very colonialist way. So we are very opposed to humanitarian intervention.
All right, good times. All right, so, and we're going to get to Iraq, I guess, probably in the second segment here. And by the way, I never did get a chance to interview you about the kind of right-wing and populist parties being elected all across Europe, and you had a really good write-up on that a couple of few months ago, and I still would like to talk with you about that sometime.
Cool.
I know you were a bit under the weather right around that time. We'll get back to that, though, because that's very interesting stuff, too. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about this article that you wrote about the Gaza war and anti-Semitism. And the way you wrote it, I'm not sure, Brent, if you let much room for somebody like me who's not anti-Semitic in the slightest bit. I even married a Jew. I like Jews so much. But, man, I hate Israel, and I can't stand them. You know, every couple of years going on these canned hunt raids like they're Dick Cheney, murdering kids and accomplishing absolutely nothing. And so I really appreciated your takedown of all the liberal hypocrites who, oh, they care so much about Gaza, but they don't care about anybody else the empire's killing anywhere else. But for some reason, this is their special issue. I appreciate that, and I'll let you talk about that if you want. But I just wonder whether you think there's much room for a point of view like mine in this, too.
Yeah, I don't think everyone who is opposed to Israel is anti-Semitic. I mean, that would be an outrageous thing to say. I'm very interested in the hypocrisy, as you say, of liberals, particularly in Europe, who didn't say anything about the bombing of Libya. They had said nothing. They supported the attack on Yugoslavia in 1999. They were pretty favorable about the war in Afghanistan in 2001. They had some problems with the war in Iraq, but, you know, not a huge problems. And then whenever Israel does anything, they go crazy. They take to the streets, they start screaming, they start going mad, they start tweeting every hour of the day about how much they hate Israel. So it got me thinking, why is it that there is this double standard? Why do liberals and lots of left-wingers only get angry when Israel takes military action? Why not when America does, or Britain, or France, or other states? And so I think it's Israel has become a kind of whipping boy. It's become a whipping boy for Western colonial guilt. And what you have is all these kind of Westerners who feel pretty shitty about the countries they live in, about the history of their nations, you know, and what they see in Israel is the perfect demonic evil figure that they can rail against and attack and scream at and feel good about themselves. You know, it looks very simplistic. It looks very black and white. Let's scream at Israel and feel good for an hour. It's much more difficult, of course, to talk about our own governments and what they are doing. That's much more complex. But it's easy. shout at Israel. So I'm just very suspicious of the one-sidedness of the anti-Israel movement.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. But then again, I mean, liberals and leftists, and, you know, I'm not one at all. So it's not like I'm trying to carry water for them too bad. But pretty much, liberals and leftists come from a very civil rightsy, non-racist, very politically correct kind of point of view themselves. And so, you know, what percentage of any of this is really, I mean, I can definitely see the partisanship angle. Don't you talk bad about my Barack Obama, who kills a Gaza war worth of people every week for the last 6 years or whatever. But as far as the anti-Semitism, I mean, maybe it's different in Europe, but I don't see a lot of Jew hatred among liberals and leftists and progressives in America.
I think it is different in Europe. I think it's worse in Europe than it is in America or Australia, or even worse than in some parts of the Arab world, where there have been relatively muted protests about Israel. But in Europe, we've seen people in Paris smashing synagogues. We've had anti-Semitic slogans painted onto synagogues in Germany and in Belfast in Northern Ireland. We have seen Jewish shops being smashed in Belgium. You know, there have been a spate of violent attacks that are explicitly anti-Semitic, and they've all been justified in terms of anti-Zionism. These people have said, we're really just angry with the Zionists, and that's why we're doing all this stuff against Jewish institutions. So when that happens, and it's happening very regularly in Europe at the moment, I think it's incumbent on liberals and progressives to take a step back and say, what is going on here? And is there any relationship between the way in which we single out Israel as the most evil state and the way in which this kind of new form of anti-Semitism is rising to the surface? I think there is a relationship between those two things. That's not to say that everyone who opposes Israel is anti-Semitic. You're not. Lots of people aren't. But I think when people focus on Israel as the most evil state, the only state that kills children, the only state that punishes innocent civilians, then I think it's not surprising that some people think, that's the Jewish state. So the Jews must also be the most evil people in the world. And I think we've unleashed a pretty dangerous sentiment in Europe in particular.
Yeah. Well, you know, I worry that, you know, Israel's behavior ends up just normalizing this kind of thing more and more and more. I remember when I first started reading Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com, I thought, oh, man, good. This thing that Donald Rumsfeld did this week, you know, I guarantee Justin's next article is going to be about that. I can't wait. And then it would be about Israel again. And I finally started wondering, well, maybe this guy actually, because that's what we're all brought up to believe, criticism of Israel means criticism of Jews, just, you know, hiding or whatever. And then I came to realize, like, no, he's really got a bone to pick with Sharon that I did not understand about how much influence they had here and just how bad their policies were. Now we got to go to break. We'll be right back. Brendan O'Neill, SpikedOnline.com. Sorry. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Oh, there you go. I'm trying to get Marjorie Cohen on the show. We got a little bit of double booking problems here. I sent out a lot of invites today, but see if we can get her on about this new piece we're running. Okay, so Brennan, are you there?
I am, yes.
Okay, so I need you to accept my contact request before I can call you on there.
Okay.
So I know it sounds everybody like a clumsy interview, but I'd rather make the change because this phone just sounds horrible. Anyway, it's Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online. That's spiked-online.com, but it'll come right up either way, I believe. And you can read all their stuff there. We're talking about you know, anti-Semitism in the anti-Israel protests, especially in Europe. And so I was telling the anecdote before the music break, the commercial break came and interrupted us about how I used to, you know, I wasn't pro-Israel necessarily, but I did not understand that, for example, one of the primary grievances of Osama bin Laden and his buddies and their recruitment shtick for the decade preceding 9/11 was American support, not for Israel's very existence, although maybe it would have been if it had just been the very existence, but specifically it was their unending wars against the people of Lebanon and Palestine. And, of course, that featured centrally in the motivation of Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker. And so now you got my attention. Why is it that America needs to make this sacrifice for Israel so that they can steal more of the rest of what's left of Palestine in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? To hell with them. I got to have my towers knocked down for that. And so I used to think, I'd hear people complaining on and on about Israel, and I would think, well, you know, maybe this guy's got a chip on his shoulder and Israel is a nice way of saying the Jews or something. But no, I really realize that I have that same chip on my shoulder, too. So I don't know what you think about that. And it doesn't look like we've made the Skype contact change here. Brandon, can you hear me? Are you there? I guess I didn't ask a very good question. Oh, there we go. Now we can switch to Skype. All right, here we go. Switch that button for that one. Can you hear me now?
Hi.
Okay, great. So, I'm sorry. I'm not sure how much of that last little rant pseudo question of mine you heard there, Brandon, but basically I was just talking about how things that used to seem to me like perhaps sort of covert anti-Semitism. It turned out to me actually was no such thing. It's just people being critical of a country that actually is really up to no good and with severe consequences for the United States.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a double standard in relation to how intense the hatred of Israel is in comparison with other states that carry out wars or do military things and so on. And I'm just interested in where that double standard comes from. I don't think it's necessarily anti-Semitic. I think in some areas it is. But even where it isn't, I do think it is disproportionate. And I'm always amazed that people, for example, protesters in Europe are saying nothing about Ukraine, for example, where forces supported by our governments are shelling one part of the country. 1,500 people have been killed, including old people and children. But we don't see any protests at all, never mind protests saying child murderer, you know, smash the Kiev state, nothing like that. So I'm just constantly struck by the fact that there is, Israel seems to get people's blood pumping in a way that no other issue does. And I think it's partly, it's become a displacement issue from talking about the far more complicated nature of Western intervention today, which is a very difficult thing to understand and oppose. And also, I think it's partly in some parts of Europe, there is an anti-Semitic element to it where Israel is singled out as the cause of all the world's problems in a similar way that the Jews used to be singled out as the cause of all the world's problems. So I think it's become too much of an easy issue. And I think anti-war people need to take a step back and ask themselves, is Israel really the cause of all the world's problems?
Yeah. Oh, certainly not. I mean, and I don't blame them for the American empire either. If America wasn't an empire, there'd be nothing for them to lobby all damn day. So, you know, I'm willing to put the responsibility everywhere that I possibly can. In fact, that's how I find my enjoyment, Brendan, is assigning responsibility for massacres and terror on as many people as I can think of to blame. But at the same time, though, I mean, you really can't ignore the fact that the neoconservatives and the Project for a New American Century and the whole idea that we must seize this moment as our unipolar time to rule the whole world and make it our way and whatever has a lot to do with just making sure that America stays engaged over there no matter what, because that's perceived by the neoconservatives to be good for Israel. Seems to me like less interventionist liberal internationalists and more paleo and libertarian type conservatives would have a lot more say in what the empire does if it wasn't for the neoconservative movement and their 35 think tanks pretending to amount to some giant consensus.
Yeah, I think it's true that, you know, for a long time, Israel played a very important role for America, and that role was kind of as a policeman in the Middle East, you know, keeping things in check, ensuring that America had influence in that part of the world. But even there, I think things are changing. I think, for example, Obama has been more critical of Israel than other presidents have been. Not as critical as some people would like, I know, but there is a break occurring. And I think in Europe, it's much more pronounced in Europe, where you will be hard-pressed to find a politician who's got a good word to say about Israel. So I think what's happening slowly but surely is that the West is distancing itself ever so slightly from Israel because it finds it quite embarrassing. And I think sometimes the anti-war movement, because it is so obsessed with Israel and it's obsessed with the fact that it still does get a large amount of military funding, it can't see the smaller, nuanced changes that are taking place in the relationship between the West and Israel. And I think it's not too fanciful to imagine that in a not too distant future, Israel could become a pariah state. It could go from being the West's friendliest state in the Middle East to being a pariah state. And that's certainly what anti-war activists want. They want Israel to be branded a rogue state or a pariah state. I'm always very struck by the fact that they use that kind of imperialistic language. Of course, rogue state is a term invented by Washington itself to demarcate civilized states from uncivilized states. So I'm always very interested in the fact that the anti-war movement in relation to Israel uses that same language of Western imperialism. So I think things are changing, things are shifting. Israel's role is not what it used to be. And I am worried about the focus on Israel above every other issue in the world.
Yeah. All right. Well, and so I'm curious now, what's your position on the actual recent conflict and or what should be done there?
Well, that's a really difficult question to answer in some ways. I mean, I'm not in favor of the war in Gaza. I think it's been very bloody. It's been very destructive. You know, I'd be the first to admit that. But I think there is a danger in focusing on this war to the exclusion of all others. And what we have now is a very partial anti-war movement, which is not really an anti-war movement at all, in Europe at least. It's an anti-Israel movement. And I think as a consequence of that, people are unaware of the fact that civilians are being slaughtered and shelled in eastern Ukraine. They're unaware of the fact that in 2 days' time is going to be the first year anniversary of the massacres in Egypt, during which nearly as many people were killed in 3 days as Israel has killed in 4 weeks. And that was done with Western arms and with Western support. So there are lots of terrible things happening around the world, which people in Europe at least are not aware of. So what I'm keen to do is to expand the focus. And I'm going to say to these people, okay, if you really are anti-war or anti-imperialist or anti-intervention, then you need to prove that. And you need to start talking about other issues than just Israel. Because at the moment, it looks to me just like a narrow anti-Israel movement, which is about stopping one particular war while allowing all the other warmongers in the world, including in Washington and London, to get off the hook.
Yeah. Well, I think I think you got a real good point there. And of course, you know, on this show, I try to be the exact opposite of that. It's easy being a libertarian, or in your case, a libertarian Marxist, where you never have any political representatives to swear loyalty to. So it's easy to just go ahead, and there's no incentive really against going ahead and being an equal opportunity attacker when it comes to these kinds of issues. But so many people get caught up in partisanship, even on these great matters of life and death. There's no doubt about it. I'm sorry we don't have time to talk Iraq, but thanks again for doing the show, and we'll talk again soon, Brendan.
Thank you, Scott.
I sure appreciate it, man. That's Brendan O'Neill, y'all. He's at SpikedOnline.com. SpikedOnline.com. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself, WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. It's a fundraising episode of the Scott Horton Show today here on Liberty Radio Network. Head on over to scotthorton.org/donate if you want. Our next guest up is the great Doug Bandow. He's at the Cato Institute, and he writes regularly for Forbes magazine. That's at Forbes.com. And this one is great. U.S. should stay out of Iraq and leave the fight to others. Thanks very much for coming back on the show. How are you doing, Doug?
Doing okay. How about yourself?
I'm doing real good, and especially now, I'm very happy to have you on the show here to state this case, because not only are you really libertarian on the issue, you actually know what you're talking about when it comes to who's who and what's what and when in the Iraq War, and so that's always very important when it comes to addressing these things and really making a bulletproof case like you do. So, well, how about it? Don't we have to go save the Yazidis or something?
Well, yeah, this is the fourth president in a row who's come up with a reason to go to war there. None of the others have ended up well. There's no reason to believe this one will. I mean, the Yazidis already are getting away, so if that was the answer, you know, then presumably we solved the problem. Instead, the president has said basically he's got to protect anywhere in Iraq where there are American personnel, which means anywhere, you know, which sounds to me like it's a real war as opposed to anything he's suggested so far.
Right. And, you know, this is the thing, actually, and I said this for a week or something on the show, and then I just forgot it as my best talking point, which was he, 3 or 4 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago, right, not long after the fall of Mosul at all, he went out and gave a talk on the White House lawn in front of the helicopter there before going off to a fundraising trip or something. And one of the things that he ticked off on his fingers was, we will not let there be a safe haven for terrorists in Iraq, which means, as long as there's an angry Sunni with a rifle, as long as there's a Sunni insurgency of any kind, then that counts as terrorism, and he's got a blank check to bomb them. He's been saying that all along here.
Yeah, see, that's the irony, is that he's calling them terrorists. I mean, these are nasty folks. I certainly don't like them. But they're acting like a government, frankly, not a terrorist group. They want to control territory. That means there's a return address, and they haven't been attacking us because they know there's no way they can survive if the U.S. would come after them. So what he's trying to do, actually, is turn them into a terrorist group, because what he will do is make us their enemies, in which case they've got to strike at us. I mean, it's completely counterproductive policy.
Right, and you know, this is the thing too, and predictable, predicted by you and me and everybody else who cared to, that this is going to guarantee that ISIS keeps their target on us. And the first day, even the Washington Post and papers like that, on the very first day of the bombings, were reporting jihadists all across the Middle East and, you know, known ISIS supporters. One, celebrating American entry into the war, which makes them fighters against the Americans, which is about the best thing that they could be for their own PR needs. And two, swearing revenge against American civilians for what our government is doing in our name.
Well, that's right.
Talk about blowback. It's backdraft,
right in your face. Pentagon officials who admitted they didn't actually know if doing this would increase or decrease the number of volunteers to ISIS. And now that's pretty stupid. I mean, if you're going to do this, you should at least have an idea of what it's going to do. Is it going to make your problem worse? And they just kind of like, well, whatever, I guess we'll find out. You know, and yes, we will find out. And the answer is probably not going to be a good one.
Well, I mean, you look back at what we already know from when we went through this before, it was that the way that David Petraeus neutralized the Sunni insurgency was he defeated George Bush. And he told him, Mr. President, you're not going to have that victory over the Sunni insurgency you've been bragging about all these years. What we're going to do instead is we're going to bribe them to stop shooting at us and to turn on the what was then al-Qaeda in Iraq. Same thing. Only that was 7 years ago now, Doug, and they never did achieve those surge benchmarks about incorporating the Sunni tribes into the government really at all or onto the oil dividend payroll or any of that stuff. And now the Islamic State, al-Qaeda in Iraq, is 10 times as powerful as it ever was.
No, that's right. I mean, what they were trying to do then is going to be much harder to do now, especially if we go in bombing and start killing Sunnis. I mean, that's the real danger, is that the moment you start getting closer to the Sunni heartland and bombing, you're going to be killing people who actually once worked with the U.S. I mean, that's the way to really make enemies. You know, we're jumping into a sectarian war here. You know, this is certainly not in our interest. The only interest it's in is in terrorists' interest, not in our interest.
Yeah, I saw at the same time, like in the same quarter hour, that Obama announced on last Friday that, oh yeah, when we say there's a red line around Erbil, we also mean there's a red line around Baghdad too. At the very same time, Muqtada al-Sadr put out a statement saying that he and his forces are ready to draw a red line around Baghdad and protect it. And I was, you know, here we go. You know, America and Muqtada al-Sadr and the Badr Brigade back together again, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Talk about strange bedfellows. And I mean, what's extraordinary, not only did the president say Baghdad, then he also in a statement said anywhere in Iraq where there are U.S. personnel. I mean, this really is an excuse to go anywhere. And he's talking, it appears to be months worth of, you know, limited strikes. Well, this is really crazy. I mean, you're going to do this for months and then you might do something else. I mean, you know, you can't conduct a war that way.
Well, and you know, the sixth grader in me watching cable news can really, you know, get with the idea of wouldn't it be fun to fly an F-16 and drop bombs on these convoys of ISIS suicide bomber prisoner crucifiers when they're in their Toyotas out in the flat open desert. But those are just images, and that's just nothing. Even if you wasted all those guys, they're just the privates. They're completely replaceable, and by wasting them, you replace them and double their numbers, right?
No, that's right. I mean, look, you know, these guys are not nice folks. I don't have a lot of worries here. If you kill some of them, are you killing bad people? The answer is pretty clearly yes. I mean, the stuff they've done is pretty hideous. But the point is, they're recruits, and what recruits them is the image of fighting some evil out there. Now they've been fighting, you know, kind of the evil Shia or, you know, the evil Kurds or something. You know, Obama's going to have them fighting the evil Americans. And we've already gone through this with al-Qaeda. We don't need to have yet another transnational group out to get us. You know, and if we're ramping up, you know, and at the same time, of course, we're fighting on the other side in Syria. I mean, this is a policy that makes absolutely no sense.
Got that right. Well, I'm not sure. There's so many different things to cover here, Doug. Let's stick with that for a minute. Hillary Clinton and every idiot on Twitter says, well, if only we had backed the moderates more, then everything would be fine. They never have to explain it, but, you know, I don't know, so I should be self-critical here. Is there a policy there that Obama could have embraced where he could have built up a third force in Syria to overthrow Assad and to destroy ISIS before they ever sacked Mosul?
Well, my reaction is, you know, look at U.S. government policy and ask yourself, could the folks in charge have gotten just the right weapons to the right people at the right time to have come up with the right result? I mean, it's a fantasy. I mean, the U.S. has been at this for decades. Basically, the entire policy in the Middle East and almost every country is in wreckage. I mean, Egypt's supposed to be our great ally. We're supposed to be making peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The Saudis are our great ally. You know, Iraq's going to be this great new... I mean, all this stuff is a wreck. The idea that, we could have manipulated Syria just a little bit differently in what democracy would have emerged, kind of like Afghanistan, you know, where we've been in complete charge. And look at how that democracy's working.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that, you know, Obama, and I don't know if he was preempting Hillary or if this was a reaction to what she had said or just a coincidence, because that narrative is really out there a lot. But he told Thomas Friedman, come on, this is a fantasy that we could have ever built up an army of regular Joes in Syria who would have been able to defeat a state army that's backed by Hezbollah and Iran and Russia. And then he didn't say, oh, and also defeat ISIS at the same time, too. But he even used the word fantasy, and yet that's been his policy. He and the CIA and the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks have been working to back the rebels there and send money and guns there all along. And he must have known, because it was even in the New York Times, Doug, David Sanger, that, oh, all the guns and money end up in the hands of the jihadists no matter what. Because, you know, guess what? Moderates don't fight. The guns goes to the guys who are going to use them.
I think the president is kind of a somewhat reluctant hawk. That is, he has these urges. He's managed to make all these horrible appointments of people who want to do all this kind of crap around the world. You know, he's got an ideology that says you're supposed to do stuff. But he's not stupid. So he kind of looks at the consequences and realizes it doesn't work out very well. And then he gets politically antsy, so he comes up with stuff like this with Iraq. Now, I've got to do something, but I shouldn't do too much. I don't know if it'll work. You know, so you come up with this weird policy that makes absolutely no sense. It has no chance of working. you know, it's too bad because, you know, of course, the neocons attack him as if he, you know, is some peacenik, which he isn't. Our Nobel Peace Prize winner here has been in more wars than George W. Bush. So, I mean, you know, where's the peace?
Right. All right. Now, I screwed up with my equipment here, Doug, and I'm having audio problems, so I had to pot down the break and everything, but I need to turn it up here. Let's take this break. We're late for it, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Doug Bandow in just a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with the great Doug Bandow from Cato and from Forbes. Barack Obama is fourth president to put Americans at risk in Iraq. U.S. should stay out and leave the fight to others, is the piece at Forbes.com. And we're running it in the viewpoints today at antiwar.com as well. You can find the link right there. And, Doug, I'd like to continue this part of the conversation about what's going on in Western Caliphate land, formerly known as Eastern Syria. On TV here, they have this whole list of all the different rebel groups in Syria that we can pick and choose to back or whatever. And then, you know, they have the Islamic Front right there next to the al-Nusra Front, when the Islamic Front is just the procurement arm of the al-Nusra Front. And every time America gives even tow missiles to the Islamic Front, they end up in the hands of al-Nusra in a day and a half anyway. And it's been that way. And, I mean, I don't know if this is, you know, has to be a question about the power of the Israel lobby in America, or if there you have some other answer here, but how in the world can they exclude the Syrian army as the most powerful anti-ISIS force in Syria, and the one that George Bush used to pay to kill these guys?
Well, the problem, of course, is that, you know, after, you know, Hillary Clinton declared that Assad was a reformer, she suddenly decided he wasn't a reformer. And since he wasn't a reformer, he had to go. So once he had to go, then it didn't really matter what the other side was. I mean, it's a policy, you know, that really makes absolutely no sense. It has an inability to set any priorities. That is, Assad's a nasty guy. I mean, this would not be my friend. However, what replaces him matters, and what you're going to do is get yourself something worse. You know, the question of what happens to minorities there and others, you know, if he falls. But then we now have ISIS, and we've seen what happens if he fails, which is a really awful alternative. And that's the problem, is they're not willing to rethink that. They've committed to getting rid of him. They can't say they were wrong, so you don't talk about him.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've seen there's this news article in the Jerusalem Post last October, but then just recently there was a clip from the Aspen something or other where Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to America, is explaining to Jeffrey Goldberg that, hey, out of all these bad actors, I prefer the Sunnis. And Goldberg is going, hey, I don't know, man. And he says, listen, no, I know that there's suicide bomber bin Ladenites, but I don't care because Hezbollah and Assad are backed by Iran. And that makes them the – he left – Maliki and the Baghdad government America put in power there out of his list, but that was what he meant too. And he said, so therefore I don't care if it's, you know, the Al-Qaeda guys, I still like them better than Hezbollah, whatever. And he kept saying, I'm only speaking for myself. And then he kept saying, from the Israeli government's point of view. And so there was really no confusing who he was representing there. That's Netanyahu's policy, is they would rather, and that was what he said last October, is the Israeli policy has always been get rid of Assad.
No, that's right. The irony is that Assad kept the peace with Israel. I mean, you know, it's not, you know, after he lost the 67 war, I mean, at some point he basically accepted the fact he wasn't going to be taking back the Golan Heights by force. And then, you know, the question is, then what's their complaint? I mean, they don't want him building nuclear weapons. I got that. But, you know, beyond that, how is this guy worse than any of these factions that could replace him? I mean, I have trouble imagining why they believe, you know, a Syria run by al-Nusra or ISIS would be better for Israel. That looks to me pretty crazy. I mean, these are all bad folks. They're bad in very different ways. None of them is going to be favorably inclined towards Israel. And the U.S. can make clear distinctions. Are they ready to attack us? Are they going to leave us alone? That's a pretty clear issue for the U.S. to make policy on.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and to that, you know, I think all the propaganda about how everybody the U.S. government ever wants to kill is Hitler is probably most apt in this case. I mean, these guys are as fanatical as real-life Nazis, but luckily they don't have a Germany to conquer here, just crappy Western Iraq with barely developed oil resources and stuff. So they're starting from way, way back compared to even post-World War I Germany. And they're surrounded on all sides, but I mean, I see all the propaganda is, hey, these guys kill kids. These guys they crucify people to death, and so we gotta stop them. How can you be Superman and not go and save this cat from a tree in this horrible of a situation? And I think, you know, to call Noriega or even Saddam or Milosevic or any of those guys Hitler, that's ridiculous. But this guy, Bin Laden incarnate here right now, who massacres people all day for fun, you know, I don't know. I sure can't argue that part of the War Party's case, Doug.
Well, you know, the good news is that what really set Hitler apart was the fact that he ran the most industrialized, most populous, and most militarized state in the center of Europe. So he actually could make good on all of his crazy ideas. You know, these guys, as you said, you know, if you want to have, you know, kind of a bit of northern Iraq, a bit of western Syria, you know, try to grab yourself some pieces of other stuff here or there, where you're opposed by Turkey, by Syria, by Lebanon, by, you know, Israel, by the Iraqi government, you know, good luck. I mean, it's one thing to launch a blitzkrieg and take stuff. Not at all clear that over the longer term they can hold any of this. And to me, that's the very different thing. They're evil, but you know, their evilness is they kill a few hundred people here, which is awful, but they're not killing millions. They simply don't have that capability.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder if you think that they just burn themselves out, because it seems like the lines are already pretty solid. Maybe they could, you know, fight for Aleppo. They surely can't take Baghdad. Maybe they could move a little bit further into Lebanon. But it seems like they're pretty well hemmed in by the states you just mentioned there. I wonder whether you think they'll, you know, right now they got the power over the tribes. But would you expect that to last? Assuming Ron Paul was in power and could just, you know, make them stop intervening now.
I mean, I think what's critical is that at some point, I suspect the Sunnis who've worked with them will grow tired of living in the 7th century. You know, the moment they lose support from other Sunnis, it's all over. And that's where we have to be so careful. We don't want to start bombing Sunnis and push them closer to ISIL. But I, you know, my question here is, where are the Turks? They have a big military. They have an air force. How about, you know, Jordan? I mean, they feel threatened. They have a nice air force. Why aren't they dropping bombs? I mean, they have a lot at stake. The U.S. always rushes in as opposed to suggesting to others in the neighborhood, by the way, this is your problem. Maybe you guys should do something.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I don't know if you have a very good read on this or if anyone does, but it seems like compared to the so-called awakening movement of 07 and all that, that the relative power between Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Sunni tribes has shifted dramatically, where they used to be a small percentage of the insurgency and never the bosses of it, really. It seems like now, you know, there was a tribe that crossed them the other day, and so they just killed all the leaders of it and were able to.
Well, what's different now is ISIL has a battle-tested force coming out of Syria. So they're actually, in a sense, they're small, but they're a real military. And I mean, it matters having training. That's one reason why the U.S. military does well. You got guys who are trained, they take out a lot of people who aren't trained. So ISIL shows up, they know how to play military, and they're kind of, you know, up against guys who know how to hold guns. It's a very uneven struggle. But over time, it's very hard to maintain that if you're trying to do this all over. I mean, if in the main Sunni areas of Iraq, everybody hates you, you know, and you have major opposition in Syria, and then if you're kind of offending the Turks, and, you know, the Jordanians are worried about you, and if, you know, ever the Iraqi, you know, kind of military gets its act in gear, you know, the parliament there has just voted to have a new prime minister, but it's not clear if Maliki will give up. So who knows what's going to happen there. Right. But I just have trouble seeing over the long term how, you know, ISIL can make this work.
Well, and so back to the American intervention there, I have trouble seeing a way for this to end pretty much ever at this point. If, you know, just protecting the civilians, Libya-style R2P, whatever, amounts to the casus belli to go back and intervene over there, as long as there are jihadists of any kind in the Sunni Triangle, they will be going after, you know, either Shia or Christians or Yazidis or Kurds or somebody. And when the Marines and the Army were there, Doug, all they did was make more and more of these guys, and eventually, as we just talked about, had to compromise with them, basically, rather than defeat them. So, obviously, air power sure as hell isn't going to annihilate them. Might drive them back underground, possibly, but it seems like even if you sent the Marines, you know, all of them, you could turn them back into an IED insurgency, but you could not eradicate the problem. The only people who could eradicate it are the locals, and so then they need to be in a state of peace to not need warriors anymore.
No, that's right. I mean, ultimately, this is a political issue, you know, within the Sunni territories and with Baghdad. We can't solve
that. But the Americans
that.
Are just going to keep escalating, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't have any other thing to do except keep escalating. Well, we tried bombing them with drones. That wasn't enough. Call out the B-52s. That wasn't enough. Call out the Marines. If Obama won't do it, Hillary or Jeb will.
Now, that's the problem, is that if what you manage to do, you know, you say you want to start small and it doesn't work, then you've committed yourself, and we will hear all of the arguments about, oh my, you know, we're committed, credibility, I mean, all those kind of things, which, of course, means the pressure will be on to do more. You know, once they're in, I don't see how they get out, because to, you know, get out without winning, whatever that is, means they failed, and they don't want to do that. They don't want the Republicans running against them on that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Isn't that what all this boils down to, is just domestic politics, too? All right, I've already kept you over time. Thanks so much, Doug. I appreciate it.
Hey, happy to be on. Take care now.
Keep writing great stuff.
We'll
that's the great Doug Bandow, everybody. He's at Cato and at Forbes Online, holding down the anti-interventionist platform for you there. U.S. should stay out of Iraq. Leave the fight to others. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys.
Whew.
Welcome back to the thing here. Yeah, see, it's me. Here's what happened is I changed some equipment around, and there was a reason I had it that other way.
I won't explain it, but anyway, the point is, it's my fault that the Brendan O'Neill interview sounded so bad. I mean, he was on a bad phone anyway, but then I had my own technical problem on top of his technical problem, just terrible. Point is, if I got my bumper music and commercials turned up loud, it's feedbacking through this computer in a way that it's not supposed to. But the sound card that I got it hooked up to, I promised I wasn't going to explain it, but now I feel like I'm lying if I don't. So I got it hooked up to the different sound card, and it's just a little bit different, and it doesn't have a checkbox for the right mute that I need. And so here I am, checkboxless. And feedback in my guess. But I don't care, because I'll just turn the music down and it'll be fine. Here in just a few minutes, I'm going to interview Eric Garris from antiwar.com about the politics of the Iraqi parliament. It's a big complicated mess, and he's not so much an expert on Iraq and Iraq's political parties and all of that, although he's pretty good on it. But what he is an expert at, that public choice operation. He wouldn't call it that. But how voting works and in which contexts. And so all those arcane kind of rules of what has to be done when and how to get people to vote for the guy they don't really want to be the libertarian nominee. He's the kind of guy who can get you to do that. He's great at that stuff. So Eric Garris from antiwar.com will be on for just a few minutes here in just a few minutes. And then, yes, it worked. I got a hold of her. It's Marjorie Cohn. And man, I better Google her name and get her latest bio. Oh, maybe it's at the bottom of this. She's of the Thomas Jefferson School of Law at the Jurist today. But she used to be the something or other at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Oops. And anyway, she's just brilliant, this lady. Like, if you were to ask about, the legal details of any of the Bush era you know, torture programs or any of that kind of thing. Man, she knows every point of fact about the cases, every point of fact about the laws and how they all apply and everything. And just, she's brilliant. And this article that she wrote is great. It's at jurist.org. U.S. leaders aid and abet Israeli war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. And let me tell you something here. I'm not a commie, and I actually hate the United Nations. I'm very John Birchy about the UN and international law and all that kind of crap. I'm an anarchist. I want to get rid of the international law first, and then the national, and then the states, and then the county, and then leave me the hell alone, you, and then we'll all be free. So I'm not all hell-bent on the letter of the law, mostly because there is no international law without a world government. In this case, i.e. the United States, to enforce it, which just goes to show why America and its allies are exempt from it and why it's no law at all. It's just like the cops can murder you and never, ever, ever be held accountable. And so, yeah, the whole thing is kind of a fishy thing, the whole concept. However, here's the thing of it, though. She does such a good job of explaining what the law is, what the international law is, and the federal laws enforcing the international law, and how it applies to what America and Israel have been doing in Gaza. That, you just got to hear it, man. I don't care what you call it. Crimes against individual humans, crimes against humanity. I'm not here to quibble. I'm here to hear her case, so it's going to be good. Marjorie Cohen here in just a little while. Oh, I ought to email her and let her know I actually won't be calling until about 5 after. I will spare you the break and call at about 5 after. Yes, see, I have to do this live because if I said something else while I was typing that, it wouldn't have worked. And if I waited, I would forget. And so it is what it is. But that's why you like the show, because I'm not just a voice in your car. I'm a person at a desk talking into a microphone. And you feel that. Jeff Kay is also coming on the show to talk about the long, tortured history of the United States backing Nazis in Ukraine. It's not ever since last fall. It's ever since the fall of 1945. Oh. Okay, 46, maybe. Anyway, Jeff Kay on the show. Yes, America supports Nazis, not just in South America, and not just in Germany before the war, and not just in Germany all during and throughout the war, like in Charles Higgins' great work, but that's Trading with the Enemy, the Nazi American Money Plot, and American Swastika, the Americans who financed Adolf Hitler. Charles Higgins, like Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M. But no, they kept backing Nazis all the way through in Eastern Europe in the Cold War versus the Reds. And you all know that. We all know that. But it's relevant to America's current crisis in Ukraine right now. And yes, the crisis in Ukraine is an American one. That is for sure. And I'm sorry that, I don't know. Maybe we'll have time. I should have a contemporary Ukraine guest today to talk about not just history, but, you know, the new stuff. But maybe we'll have time with Jeff Kay to discuss a little of the new stuff, too. But there's a war going on in the East, and there's a threat of Russian humanitarian intervention, which the Americans say would be completely beyond the pale as they bomb the hell out of Iraq in the name of the Yazidis, which is a joke, which some people fell for. Anyway, yeah. So that's enough about what's coming up on the show. You could just stay tuned and you'd hear it. So good. I got to talk about the Hillary-Obama controversy over back in the moderate rebels. Oh, Obama told Thomas Friedman that his biggest regret in foreign policy so far was that after the Libya war against Gaddafi, which of course was great, America didn't invade and stay and train up an army and build a democracy. Oh, their fledgling democracy is being challenged. Really? You think maybe because the entire war was basically fought for? Look, the only guys with guns who fought in the war with the Western special forces and spies and planes in the air were the jihadists. And we didn't find this out after the fact. We knew this before the so-called no-fly zone was ever declared. And it took 9 months for them to hunt down and kill Gaddafi in 2011. It took 9 months for them to finally take Tripoli, even with American air power, because as Patrick Coburn reported from the front, there are more of us journalists here than there are Mujahideen. But as far as who's doing the fighting, yeah, it's the Mujahideen. It's the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and it's Ansar al-Sharia, and it's these guys who are veterans of the Iraq War. Just like after the Afghan War, a bunch of Mujahideen went home to cause more trouble in the places they were from. Same thing happened after Bush's adventure in Iraq. A lot, and, you know, for a time when AQI died down there between, say, you know, 2009 and 2011, a lot of them went home to Syria and, of course, to Libya. And those were the guys that they fought the entire war for. But then, like Woodrow Wilson saying, oh, no, World War II and all the other consequences to come are all your fault because you didn't ratify the League of Nations Treaty, which was a joke, which wouldn't have guaranteed world peace in anything but your, you know, fifth grade social studies teacher's imagination and Wilson's. But anyway, no, World War II and all the negative consequences of World War I, they aren't Woodrow Wilson's fault. He fought the war with the greatest intentions, therefore with the greatest of results. Other than, oh, those dastardly reactionary right-wingers wouldn't adopt the League of Nations world government, blah, blah. And therefore, problems. Same thing with Obama here. Telling Tom Friedman from the New York Times that, oh, yeah, if only we had really doubled and tripled down into Libya like Scott Horton warned was going to happen and sent in troops to train up their army. They did have a purple-fingered election. Right now, America is backing... Okay, I don't know this 100% for a fact, but yeah, I mean, come on, it's pretty damned obvious that the American CIA is backing, or I don't know, maybe Obama's too much of a coward to do a damn thing these days. I don't know what the hell he's doing. But there is a guy who definitely was a CIA agent for 20 years, or not agent, but or literally agent, not officer, you know, worked for them, but not one of them. But their sock puppet lived in Virginia for 25 years, used to work for Gaddafi, got captured in the war in Chad. Lived in Virginia for 25 years and then parachuted on in there and is now at war in the name of, you know, al-Sisi in Egypt-style secular military dictatorship to protect from the Islamists that America fought the war for. In other words, he's fighting Haftar, the probable CIA asset, is right now fighting to become Muammar Gaddafi again. And you got to admit, at least it makes sense to try to put in a secular military dictator rather than outright fighting a war for the freaking Mujahideen, for the veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who are now the caliphate over the horizon. Oh, Obama says, no, the war wasn't fighting, the problem wasn't fighting a war for the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia. It's that we should have sent in 10,000 Marines to occupy the country and make sure everything was wonderful. Not his words, but that was what it would have taken. Or maybe a hell of a lot more than that. Actually, now I say 10, I think maybe I meant 100. If you told the Army 10, they'd have said 100. And I guess the U.S. doesn't really care if there's chaos in Libya. Just keep it away from the oil fields, which most of which are in the far east of the country and out of the major turmoil. But anyway, yeah, the absolute unmitigated arrogance of Barack Obama is unbelievable. That's the position that he would take on the Libya war. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show.
And, yeah, coming up, Marjorie Cohn and Jeff K. We're going to talk about some stuff. Right now, though, we got Eric Garris. He's the managing, whatever, director, boss, guy that runs antiwar.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Eric?
Fine. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. So, first of all, let's talk about Iraqi politics for a minute here. There's rumors of coups and counter-coups and military responses and all kinds of crisis. Nouri al-Maliki does not want to step down. And so please break it down for us. Who's doing what in the Iraqi parliament today?
Well, as most of your listeners probably know, there's been a political battle over the last several months to pick a new prime minister after the last elections. Maliki wants a third term, and a lot of people oppose that. He's been unable to get a majority of the parliament to agree to choose him. So they keep adjourning and then trying to figure something out and then reconvening and failing again. So yesterday the parliament met again, and after several hours they were unable to choose a new prime minister designate, so they agreed to adjourn for 9 days. At that point, Maliki demanded that the new president, the president is always a Kurd in this new government system.
What? You're fading away on me here, man.
I said the president is always a Kurd,
right,
in this new government.
Mm-hmm.
The prime minister is always a Shia, and the speaker is always a Sunni. So the only thing they have chosen is the Sunni, the new Sunni speaker, and the new Kurdish president.
Right.
So the new president doesn't have that much power. It's mainly a prime minister has most of the power, but the president could designate a new person to try and form a government, and they haven't done that yet.
Sort of like the president of Israel, it sounds like, right?
What?
Sort of like the president of Israel's position.
Yes, yes. Or
he doesn't really do anything other than say, now it's your turn to form a government to try to.
Right. Uh-huh. It's primarily ceremonial. There are a few other minor powers, but that's about it. So the Maliki demanded that since they had been unable to pick a designate by their deadline constitutionally, that the president was required to renominate Maliki and that he would try and form a government and be the caretaker leader, to continue to be the caretaker leader. The new president, Mahmoud, refused to do it. And Maliki said that was a violation of the Constitution. He accused him of fomenting a coup, and he's now brought charges against him, and he deployed tanks around the Green Zone, which houses the Iraqi government facilities and also the U.S. Embassy. At that point, the U.S. finally said Maliki has to go. So, and they backed the new president's call to get rid of him.
Is that the order that it happened in? He called out the tanks, and then they endorsed the president's maneuver?
It
publicly
happened so almost simultaneously, it's hard to say which happened first. Yeah. But I believe that that's the case.
I mean, it does certainly sound like they were behind it for them to get, you know,
I'm sure there's at least coordination between the anti-Maliki forces and the U.S. government, perhaps the CIA.
Yeah.
And I think Maliki,
because he didn't really, if I understand you right, Eric, the president didn't really do anything, but that's the problem, is he was supposed to go ahead and let Maliki try to form another government.
Now,
he didn't really mount a coup or anything. It was just the beginnings of what could have been one or something.
No, but Maliki fears, and I think rightly so, the CIA. He's afraid that he's gonna get the Diem treatment.
Yeah. Well, right. The fact that they spoke up, that the State Department came out and endorsed what was going on, is pretty much proof that he's right about that.
Right. Now, this morning, the Shiite National Alliance picked a new nominee for prime minister, Al-Abadi. Now, he's been in the running multiple times for prime minister, and he is a member of the Dawah Party, and he's a part of the State of Law Coalition, which is Maliki's ruling coalition. But he was nominated by the other chief Shiite bloc, which is mainly made up of the Sadrist movement and the Supreme Islamic Council, mm-hmm. which is pro-Iran.
So now, is the Dawah Party, do you know if the Dawah Party is actually been kind of folded into Maliki's State of Law, or he's actually broken off a couple of years ago and made his own government party separate from Dawah now?
It's still technically part of the State of Law Coalition, but not everyone in the Dawah Party is a Maliki supporter, even if they're still part of the ruling bloc at the moment.
Right.
But here's what all the mainstream media is reporting this morning is that the Iraqi Shiites have chosen a new prime minister and that the president has asked him to form a government. The problem is that parliament hasn't voted on this, and there are many members of the Dawah Party, including people who have been critical of Maliki, who says, no, we don't like this guy. We're not supporting him. So it's unclear that Al-Abadi is going to have any more support than some of the other people that they've tried to put forward. So at this point, nothing has really changed in terms of the deadlock in the Iraqi parliament.
Well,
until they reconvene, which is now scheduled from 8 days from today, they could move that up. But until that happens, nothing is going to happen from a legal and constitutional perspective. Now, what may happen, extra-legally, I think that there are a lot of possibilities of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, from drones to a bullet to the back of the head or whatever, rendition him off to Egypt for
right.
the Mubarak treatment.
By the way, Al-Abadi spent over 2 decades in England. He spent over 2 decades in England during most of Saddam's rule. So he's a very Western-oriented guy.
And that's the Kurd who's the president now?
No. This is Al-Abadi. He is the...
Oh,
new
he's the
Shiite designate for prime minister.
Oh.
Or the National Alliance designate. Now, the National Alliance, keep in mind, is still the second largest bloc in parliament.
Right, and that's the Supreme Islamic Council.
And the Sadrist Alliance. Yes, exactly.
Right. And now, so what's important, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this for people listening here, that the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah Party... In their, not entirely, but almost entirely, spent the time from Saddam's invasion of Iran in 1980 all the way through Bush Jr.'s invasion of Iraq in 2003 in Iran. They were the Iraqi traitors who took Iran's side in the Iran-Iraq war, and then America fought for them to put them in power all this time. So really what we're talking about here is still just a choice of one, two, or three of the Iranian parties, but I guess you're saying this guy, he's part of their network, but he's much closer to the West than the Iranians, it sounds like.
Yes, but indications are he has the backing of Iran. Iran said last week that they were working on trying to find someone who was acceptable to them to replace Maliki, and the fact that the National Alliance has put forward Al-Abadi would indicate to me that Iran is supporting Al-Abadi at this point.
Yeah.
And so is the U.S.
Well, and this is all deck chairs on the Titanic anyway,
according to their
official policy.
None of this is going to change anything in terms of what's happening in Iraq unless there's a coup or counter-coup. And then that will have a significant effect, a reverberation throughout Iraq, that's going to make the other things that are going on much worse. And I think that that's not certainly, I'm not saying it's absolutely the most likely thing that will happen, but I think it is a likely possibility that you'll see Maliki ousted in an extra legal manner, or that there will be an attempt to do that and Maliki will counter and just take dictatorial powers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems like if he's not taking the hint from Sistani, then he's willing to fight for it no matter what.
Yes, clearly he's not leaving. He's not interested in taking his riches and being jetted off to a foreign country where he can live out his life in luxury. He wants to keep the power.
All right, well, I got to let you go, but thank you very much for your time.
All right, take it easy, Scott.
All right, y'all, that is Eric Garris. Oh, man, wait, are you still there? That's Eric Garris. He's the managing director of antiwar.com, and it's their fund drive right now, and I know I've been begging y'all for money, too, but you got to support antiwar.com. It's the most important site on the internet, and if it wasn't there, what would you do? Seriously. If the world didn't have antiwar.com, are you kidding me? It's a nightmare. So do what you can to help support. And that helps me a little bit, too. So antiwar.com/donate. We'll be right back with Marjorie Cohn in just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Marjorie Cohn of the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and I believe formerly the director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Right, Marjorie?
No, formerly the president of the National Lawyers Guild.
Oh, the National Lawyers Guild. Man,
yes.
I screw these things up sometimes.
But we do work with CCR.
Okay, great. Yeah. All right, and you do great work, and you write great articles, too. I sure love reading them. This one is at Jurist, which actually is an extra little thrill for me because I imagine that this has a very elite and important audience that you're speaking to here as well, and so I think that's really important. But so anyway, here it's called U.S. Leaders Aid and Abet Israeli War Crimes, Genocide, and Crimes Against Humanity. Wow, Marjorie, I know you must be serious to put it that way. You want to, first of all, I guess, take us through which are the laws that you think are being broken and then how?
Yes, and I want to say that the reason that I said that U.S. leaders are aiding and abetting these war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity is because in the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, an individual can be convicted of one of these crimes if he or she, and I'm reading right out of the statute, aids, abets, or otherwise assists in the commission or attempted commission of the crime, including providing the means for its commission. And U.S. military aid, which has been approved by members of Congress, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, that military aid has aided, abetted, and assisted the commission of these crimes by providing Israel with the military means to commit them. Now, there are three different categories of crimes that we're talking about. This is right out of the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. One category of crimes is war crimes. One is crimes against humanity, and the other is genocide. So first of all, war crimes. There are seven possible war crimes that Israeli leaders and U.S. leaders aiding and abetting them could be convicted of in the International Criminal Court. And the first one is willful killing. So I'm going to mention the crime, which is specified in the International Criminal Court statute, and then I'll talk about the evidence supporting the allegation of that crime. Mm-hmm. So willful killing, Israeli forces have killed nearly 2,000 Palestinians, more than 400 children, and more than 80% of them civilians. Israel used 155-millimeter artillery, which, according to Human Rights Watch, is utterly inappropriate in a densely populated area because it's considered accurate if it lands any place within a 50-meter radius. The second war crime is willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health. Nearly 10,000 people, 2,500 of them children, have been wounded. UNICEF said the Israeli offensive has had a catastrophic and tragic impact on the children in Gaza, and about 373,000 children have had traumatic experiences and need psychological help. And UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees said there's a public health catastrophe going on. Most of the medical facilities in Gaza are non-operational. The third war crime is unlawful and wanton extensive destruction and appropriation of property not justified by military necessity. At least 60,000 Palestinians have lost their homes because they've been destroyed by the Israeli forces. And the damage to sewer and water infrastructure has affected two-thirds of Gazans. The reconstruction of Gaza is estimated at $6 billion. In addition, Dennis Kucinich wrote a piece saying that Israel shrunk Gaza's habitable land mass by 44% by establishing a 3-kilometer no-go zone for Palestinians. So 147 square miles of land will be compressed into 82 square miles. And Oxfam described the level of destruction as outrageous, much worse than anything we have seen in previous Israeli military operations. The fourth war crime is willfully depriving a prisoner of war or a civilian the rights of fair and regular trial. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians were arrested by Israeli forces just in the month of July alone, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies. And these prisoners included 15 members of the Palestinian Legislative Council, about 240 children, dozens of women, journalists, activists, academics, and 62 former prisoners previously released in a prisoner exchange. Now, this is something that is not widely known, but Israeli forces executed many prisoners after arrest, no trial, either by directly firing on them, refusing to allow them treatment, or allowing them to bleed to death. And more than 445 prisoners are being held without charge or trial under administrative detention, and that is also illegal.
And Marjorie, I'm sorry, just a quick point of fact here. This is in Gaza, or this is people abducted in the West Bank as well?
In the West Bank as well. And there are also reports that have come out. Max Blumenthal wrote a piece on August 8th in Alternet saying that Israel is pursuing a shoot-to-kill or shoot-to-cripple policy against demonstrators. And so not only are they arresting people and letting them die if they were wounded, but over the last 6 months, the army has started firing at protesters' knees, femurs, or aiming at their vital organs. And Blumenthal is quoting Dr. Rajai Abu Khalil, who is a resident physician who is working in Gaza. And he says that there are dum-dum bullets, which are being used, which are banned under customary human rights law because the ammunition is designed to cause extreme damage to tissue by expanding outwards upon entry, thereby preventing the bullet from exiting. And Dr. Abu Khalil said, "You can't extract it. It goes in and explodes and expands outwards. If you try to remove it, you could harm the muscle or bone. So if it hits the bone, you just have to keep it there." The fifth type of war crime is intentionally directing attacks against the civilian population, civilian objects, or humanitarian vehicles, installations, and personnel. a joint declaration of over 150 international law experts said the civilian population in the Gaza Strip is under direct attack. And this violates the principle of distinction, which forbids deliberate attacks on civilians or civilian property or objects. Israeli forces bombed 142 schools, 89 of which were run by the UN, including six UN schools where civilians were taking refuge. And Israeli forces shot and killed fleeing civilians. Now, they said, well, we gave them warnings first. But warnings have to effectively give civilians time to flee during the bombing. And even if they do give warnings, that does not relieve Israel from its legal obligations not to target civilians. Israeli forces repeatedly bombed Gaza's only power plant and other infrastructure, which are, quote, beyond repair, unquote. Israel bombed one-third of Gaza's hospitals, 14 primary health care clinics, and 29 ambulances. And according to Amnesty International, Israel is targeting doctors. At least five medical staff were killed. Tens of others were injured. The sixth war crime is intentionally launching attacks with knowledge they will cause incidental loss of life or injury to civilians or damage to civilian objects or long-term severe damage to the natural environment if they're clearly excessive in relation to the anticipated military advantage. The principle of proportionality forbids disproportionate and excessive civilian casualties compared to the claimed military advantage gained in the attack. And Israel is using, once again, what is called the Dahiye Doctrine. And according to the UN Human Rights Council, or Goldstone Report, the Dahiye Doctrine involves the application of disproportionate force and causing of great damage and destruction to civilian property and infrastructure and suffering to civilian populations. So that Dahiye Doctrine directly violates that proportionality requirement. So responding, ostensibly responding to Hamas's rockets with 155 military artillery is disproportionate. And although nearly 2,000 Palestinians, over 80% of them civilians, have been killed, 67 Israelis, all but three of them soldiers, have been killed. Also, the coordinates of all UN facilities were repeatedly communicated to Israeli forces, according to the U.S. State Department, and Israel nevertheless bombed them multiple times. The seventh war crime...
Now, I'm sorry, Marjorie, let me stop you there. We're actually a little bit over, but let's take this break, and then when we come back, we can pick back up with number seven here and then follow-ups.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Hold on. It's Marjorie Cohen from the Thomas Jefferson School of Law writing here at jurist.org. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. And hey, especially this week, scotthorton.org/donate. You can find also all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. Right now, I'm in the middle of talking with Marjorie Cohen from the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and this article is at jurist.org. U.S. leaders aid and abet Israeli war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. And we're going to have to do some follow-ups about the U.S. role and some of the other points of fact here. But we're going down the list here, and you're doing really great here. We were on number seven under the category of war crimes. Marjorie, please continue.
Yes. This war crime is called attacking or bomb, and these are war crimes that are set forth in the International Criminal Court statute. Attacking or bombarding undefended towns, villages, dwellings, or buildings, or intentionally attacking religious, educational, and medical buildings which are not military objectives. On July 20th, Israeli forces virtually flattened the small town of Kuzaa. One man counted 360 shell attacks in 1 hour. And Israeli forces bombed 142 schools, one-third of Gaza's hospitals, 14 primary health care clinics, and 29 ambulances, and unknown numbers of homes of Gazans, and completely destroyed 41 mosques and partially destroyed 120 mosques. Now, the second category of crimes is genocide, and the genocide is you can be convicted of genocide if, with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, Palestinians, primarily civilians, and Palestinian infrastructure necessary to sustain life were deliberately targeted by Israeli forces. So that is the intent part of it. And then the intent, with that intent, the commission of any one of these three acts. Number one, either killing members of the group, and Israeli forces killed nearly 2,000 Palestinians, or number two, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, Israeli forces wounded 10,000 Palestinians, or number three, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its destruction in whole or in part. Israeli forces devastated Gaza's infrastructure, knocked out Gaza's only power plant, destroyed homes, schools, buildings, mosques, and hospitals. And the third category of crimes that are punished in the International Criminal Court are called crimes against humanity, and I'm going to talk about three of them. First, the commission of murder as part of a widespread or systematic attack against any civilian population. Israeli forces relentlessly bombed Gaza for 1 month, killing nearly 2,000 Palestinians, more than 80% civilians, and they intentionally destroyed Gaza's infrastructure, knocking out its only power plant, destroying homes, schools, buildings, mosques, and hospitals. The second crime against humanity is persecution against a group or collectivity based on its political, racial, national, ethnic, or religious character as part of a widespread or systematic attack against any civilian population. Israeli forces killed, wounded, summarily executed, and administratively detained Palestinians, Hamas forces, and civilians alike. Israeli forces intentionally destroyed the infrastructure of Gaza, which is populated by Palestinians. And then the third crime against humanity is the crime of apartheid. And in order to commit the crime of apartheid, you have to commit inhumane acts in the context of an institutional regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another racial group with the intent to maintain that regime. Ali Hayek, who was the head of Gaza's Federation of Industries, which represents 3,900 businesses that employ 35,000 people, said, "After 30 days of war, the economic situation has become like dead. It seems the occupation intentionally destroyed these vital factories that constitute the backbone of the society." That's his quote. Israel maintains an illegal barrier wall that encroaches on Palestinian territory. The International Court of Justice, or the World Court, found that it was illegal. Israel builds illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. Israel keeps Gazans caged in what many call the world's largest open-air prison. Israel controls all ingress and egress to Gaza, limits Gazans' access to medicine, subjects Palestinians to arbitrary arrest, expropriates their property, maintains separate areas and roads, segregated housing, different legal and educational systems for Palestinian and Jews, and prevents mixed marriages. And only Jews, not Palestinians, have the right to return to Israel, Palestine. Now, I also discussed another crime which is not included in the statute for the International Criminal Court, but it is considered to be a war crime because it is a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and that's called collective punishment. Collective punishment means punishing a civilian for an offense he or she has not personally committed, and it forbids reprisals against civilians and their property. So ostensibly to rout out Hamas fighters, Israel has wreaked unprecedented devastation on the people of Gaza, killing nearly 2,000 people, more than 80% civilians, and destroying much of the infrastructure of Gaza. And this constitutes collective punishment. On August 5th, veteran Israeli military advisor Giora Eiland advocated collective punishment of Gaza's civilian population, saying, quote, "In order to guarantee our interests versus the other side's demands, we must avoid the artificial, wrong, and dangerous distinction between the Hamas people, who are the bad guys, and Gaza's residents, who are allegedly the good guys," unquote. And that is precisely the strategy Israel has employed in this war. Also, Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands constitutes collective punishment. Israel maintains effective control over Gaza's land, airspace, seaport, electricity, water, telecommunications, and population registry, and Israel deprives Gazans of food, medicine, and fuel and basic services. So that is the evidence supporting the request to the International Committee, International Criminal Court prosecutor, to investigate Israeli leaders and military commanders, as well as for war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity under the statute of the International Criminal Court, as well as U.S. leaders who have funded and made possible the commission of these crimes.
All right, now. I'm sorry, we don't really have a time to get into the prospects for actual indictments and prosecutions here. I mean, that could be a whole other interview, in fact. But this is one hell of an indictment that you have just read through here for us, Marjorie. It's really something else. It really, all the different pieces together really put it in context, and especially as you contrast it with the mandates of these international agreements and the federal laws that Congress has passed enforcing American participation with these international agreements. I guess I would just like to go back over, really. I mean, I have a few, but the most important thing to go back over, we're already over time, so I'm sorry, real quick here, but I guess I'm only just learning now that genocide does not necessarily, at least in the law, does not necessarily require an attempt to eradicate an entire ethnicity of people, like all Arabs, but even just a nationality, even if it's a tiny little nationality like the Palestinians in Gaza, if their entire ability to continue to exist as the Palestinian community there in Gaza is destroyed, that amounts to genocide under the letter of the law. So in other words, even if half the Jews in the world are in Israel and half the Jews are somewhere else, if someone really tried to obliterate Israel, that could be considered a genocide too, an attack on an entire nation of people, something like that. Is that correct?
Well, it doesn't. They don't have to actually succeed. They have to have the intent to destroy in whole or in part. So it doesn't have to be the whole thing. Intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group.
Right.
Pardon me?
It's the or in that list. It doesn't have to be an
ethnicity. Yes, in whole or in part. Mm-hmm. And so in conjunction with that intent to destroy in whole or in part a group based on their race or religion or nationality, only one of the following acts needs to be committed: killing members of the group, and Israel has killed nearly 2,000 Palestinians, mm-hmm. causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Israel has wounded 10,000 Palestinians, or deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its destruction in whole or in part.
And now, is your evidence about their intent just the results, or do you have something better about their declared, I guess, the Dahiye doctrine, you call it?
Yes, there have been statements that have been made by Israeli leaders about destroying the Palestinians. The fact that so many Palestinians have been killed, the fact that Israel bombed the infrastructure necessary to sustain life, they deliberately targeted that infrastructure, shows the intent to destroy in whole or in part the Palestinians.
All right, I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Marjorie. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott.
That's the great Marjorie Cohn, everybody, formerly with the National Lawyers Guild, now at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and at jurist.org. You can find the spotlight today on antiwar.com. U.S. leaders aid and abet Israeli war crimes, genocide and crimes against humanity. We'll be right back in just one sec. Oh, man, I bet I'm already back, aren't I? No, I'm not. Okay, good. Back in one sec with Jeff K. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Well, dang, I could have kept going with Marjorie. Well, I think she probably had to go anyway, but I was recording her into the break there. What a mess. And now I can't reach Jeff K. He was going to try to squeeze me in there at work, so I don't know if he must have just had something at work come up, but I'm going to try him again in the next segment. Oh, what the hell? You guys don't care if there's a ringing phone in the background, do you? Let's see if I can get him to answer here. It's the Scott Horton Show. I could take this time, if I can't reach Jeff, we could talk about what's going on in Ferguson with the riots and the police shooting and all that. Plenty to talk about there. And well, plenty of Gaza, Ukraine news. I got Ukraine and Iraq, of course, formerly known as Iraq news. It's really not. We really need to decide what we're going to call it. The Caliphate, Shiistan, Kurdistan, is that it? All right. Well, we're not reaching Jeff K, but I'll try again at the next segment. Man, I got to address the... I guess I do. The shooting of this guy, the cops say, oh, they had a scuffle or whatever. Who knows? But anyway, he was unarmed. And the eyeball witnesses say he had his hands in the air and was complying. This is in a town near St. Louis. And the cop just blasted him multiple times. And I think people are saying many multiple times. Unarmed black guy. And I think right there in the middle of the projects, and then they left his body laying there, or at least the apartment complex. I know it looked pretty bad, but then they left him just laying there in front of everybody for 4 hours. I don't know how long it took him before they finally even put a sheet over him. They left him on the street there in front of everyone, you know, to deprive his corpse of any last remaining shred of dignity. And then, of course, you have a massive protest by... almost entirely, I guess, black people. Nobody else cares. Is that it? I don't know. But they came out for this one. Enough of this, right? There's got to be a limit at some point where people push back and say, hey, man, you can't. It's, you know, we know this is the USA and it's open season for government employees to murder any black people that they feel like and everything. But could you tone it down just a notch, guys? For crying out loud, man. Terrorized people sometimes can react pretty crazily, dude. How bad does the state of Missouri and its stormtroopers of death mean to push this anyway? Security force, nothing. They are the most violent and dangerous force in society. The cops and the politicians they serve. Low-level black market drug crimes and the violence associated with that is the worst that you can pin on poor black people. It's stupid. It's completely ridiculous. It's all government-manufactured offenses, just like their racist gun laws. Oh, liberals love gun laws, but see what happens if you point out to one that who does time for gun possession charges? Poor black people, that's who. Oh, yeah, in your imagination, if you pass a law, then all the guns will go away. In reality, they pass a law, a bunch of black people go to jail, not for using a gun against someone in a criminal way, but just for having one when he's not allowed to. Yeah, great. Just like with the drugs, just like anything else. And anyway, so poor black people in ghettos all over America basically are feeling all the time more and more, and depending on the year and the state of the economy at any given time, they're feeling a lot like Gazans. The fact that they threw a couple of, you know, broke a few windows, I guess burnt down a Quickie Mart is supposed to be the top headline here. But what is that other than they have no other way to fight back? They have no power at all. Democracy, schmocracy, nothing. Poor black people in the ghetto of St. Louis, they don't have the ability to make the government stop killing them. There's nothing that they can do other than what? Cry to Jesus, what can we do? They don't have any power. And so, yes, the youngest and malest and, 20-year-oldest of them all end up breaking windows and stealing Twinkies and ding-dongs from 7-Eleven. So what? The point is, the cops came out. Actually, I skipped a big step. The cops came out when all the poor black people came outside to protest peacefully. The cops brought out their new MRAP mine-resistant vehicle. And brought out all their machine guns and their SWAT gear and their riot gear and their German shepherds. And, you know, I don't know what kind of electroshock device they have embedded in those cops to prevent them from screaming the N-word at the top of their lungs while they're deploying all this stuff against these poor people. But, you know, I'm not excusing burning down a Quickie Mart. It's stupid. But the point is, why would anybody riot when the cops come and kill their family members with impunity, endlessly, when there's nothing that they can do about it? What do you expect them to do? You know? It's the same thing. I'm sitting here arguing on Twitter about Israel and Palestine, like Palestine is the nation state next door. When Palestine, especially Gaza, is the point of contention here, Gaza is a prison. It's a concentration camp full of conquered and defeated refugees of the land that Israel now calls Israel. And then they're just penned in a maximum security prison. Hamas is just the strongest prison gang in the prison. That is, its borders and its everything are completely controlled by Israel. The people there have no rights whatsoever. Like in the Soviet Union, they can't leave. They're prisoners. Oh, boo-hoo, they shot some rockets over the wall of their prison. Like this is some kind of aggressive war launched by the Palestinian state and an invasion of Israel, and poor little besieged Israel has to defend itself. You couldn't even fit that crap in a comic book. Well, you know, I can believe that all I want. All I have to do is just pretend I don't know a thousand things that make that a ridiculous, stupid lie. The people of Gaza have been conquered all along now, longer than I've lived. Since 1967, since the summer of love, in some other lost hippie era, they've been conquered and occupied by the Israelis. It's the same thing here with poor black people in ghettos all across the United States. And, you know, even in Austin, Texas, which is like unreal. It's such a nice place to live. I've lived here my whole life. I'm not one of these California transplant types. I'm from here. Well, my dad's a California transplant type, but that's all right because I'm from here my whole life long. Anyway, it's a great place. It really is. It's one of the nicest places. And if you went to the meanest ghetto in Austin on a Friday night, they'd probably offer you a prostitute and maybe to sell you some drugs. And I guess you could get jumped. I'm not saying you definitely would not get jumped, but there's nowhere in Austin where somebody has to say, hey, listen, white people cannot go into that neighborhood, okay? Be careful. You can't do it. There is not a neighborhood like that. Now, I had people tell me that when I was in New Orleans. They said, you see those red houses over there? Don't go past those houses. It's just a warning. We don't have any neighborhoods that down and out in Austin. And yet, I-35 absolutely is a dividing line between black and white, and brown too, Mexicans too. And it's not like it's actually any worse of a place to live over on the east side of Austin, Texas, but it absolutely still is de facto segregation all this time. And so I can only imagine what it's like, a town like St. Louis that used to be something and has entire populations built up on industries that no longer exist there, massive delocations and dislocations and poverty and political powerlessness. But anyway, it's the cops, man. They're the murderers. And the reason that they keep murdering people is because they know that they can get away with it. They have complete impunity and immunity to kill whoever they want. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show, wrapping up for today. We got Jeff K. on the line. He's a psychologist from the Bay Area in California. And has worked with torture victims in the past and that kind of thing. And he writes at dissenter.firedoglake.com. You can also follow him on Twitter. This article, the latest, another great one, at dissenter.firedoglake.com is CIA intervention in Ukraine has been taking place for decades. Sorry, Jeff, it's been one of those days.
Okay.
Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
What do you mean? Fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us today. Decades, sure. Huh? Well, I thought America backed their first Nazi in Ukraine starting back last November.
Yeah, I know. Well, if you read the American press, you would think Ukraine as a nation suddenly appeared on the American scene, a year or two ago. History is not something that the media in this country takes very seriously, and that's because who wants uncomfortable questions about what's gone on when, you know, to get in the way of what the U.S. is trying to do right now. So,
all right,
you
so,
know, the,
I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, so the reason I wrote, you know, really the title of my article says it all. CIA intervention in Ukraine has been taking place for decades, 7 decades to be precise, ever since really the inception of the Cold War and the end of the World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. And, you know, there's a whole history of the use of the United States government you know, as the Cold War came up and they saw now not Nazi Germany, but Soviet Russia as their primary enemy, they then turned to fascists in Europe. And actually, they did similar things with the Japanese imperial enemy in the Far East to become new allies. It didn't matter that these people were pogromists and outright fascists themselves. They were utilized in ways that at first were quite brutal. They parachuted people in into the Soviet Union that were recruited from former fascist nationalist groupings in Europe and set up underground networks with the idea that they were going to overthrow, you know, the Soviet Union and its different satellite states, or the ones that they were setting up. They weren't called satellite states then. And that was where it began. I mean, literally, there was I wrote about this in another article once. It was taking place in the displaced persons camps throughout Europe. You know, World War II displaced millions of people. And in these camps, which where people had been sent across Europe as slave laborers by the Nazis, trying to find their way back home, Ukrainian refugees were a hefty amount of them. And in these camps already, under something called Operation Ohio, the U.S. made an alliance with fascistic elements in the Ukrainian nationalist movement. And this created in which they were looking supposedly, and no doubt they were looking for, as well, for Soviet agents among these displaced persons in the camps. And there were murders in the camps and At the same time, they were looking for Soviets. Different factions within the Ukrainian fascist movement were trying to kill their different faction members. It was really quite brutal. And out of this came a dispute between the Americans and the British about which group of fascists to support. All of this can seem like ancient history and would be ancient history if it wasn't that today and for decades coming out of that, the United States government is part of the Cold War, of course, financed essentially the Ukrainian nationalist opposition and that in other states too, the Baltic states, Poland, etc., with the idea of helping overthrow the Soviet Union. And sure, lo and behold, the Soviet Union did finally fall in 1991. But that didn't mean that the connection between the United States and these other governments was sundered. I mean, see, and these oppositionists was sundered. And in fact, what you saw after were a series of these so-called, you know, color revolutions in the Caucasus.
Well, you know what? Hold that thought for a second.
Yeah.
Because I
want
to ask about, during the Cold War, just how successful was the CIA at keeping ties with these various right-wing groups, you know, in Eastern Europe and the, you know, the Soviet republics like Ukraine? I mean, having a bunch of stay-behind right-wing terrorists ready to fight mm-hmm. in Western Europe in case the Soviets ever invade, I mean, that's easy, right? NATO's all over the place. But how successful were they really at, you know, for example, keeping the Banderist movement in Ukraine going during all the dark times of the Soviet occupation there?
Well, I mean, by the way, you bring up a good point. There was a network of stay-behind, which we today know as the Gladio organization, run through NATO and the CIA, which ostensibly was used to prevent, you know, to be in place if the Soviets invaded. But by the 1970s and 80s, were used as right-wing shock troops against left-leaning governments in Europe and also in Latin America. And that's where a lot of false flag terror attacks by the right wing were used to help bring, you know, bring down left-leaning governments in Italy, for instance, and elsewhere.
Short on time, but though.
Oh, sorry.
It's a great tangent. I like talking about it, too. But
yeah. But how successful? They changed their tactics from outright, you know, sabotage and covert warfare to, you know, financing groups of intelligentsia and groups like Prologue, a publishing company, which was in the Ukraine. And it was through these groups, and no doubt we don't have all the information because it just has never been released about, you know, what we do know is that by today, the fascists in Ukraine, in fact, had been utilized once again. People like Svoboda and Right Sector were brought into the Ukrainian government, you know, so a lot of this is supposition, but it appears through things like the National Endowment for Democracy, USAID, and the State Department, and probably under it the CIA, mm-hmm. you know, were being utilized to, you know, keep in touch with and support all along these groups who were fascist or fascist-linked.
You know what, I want to go back and look at 2004 and the Orange Revolution and see what role these right-wing groups played then. Svoboda and Right Sector particularly.
Yeah, no, I would like to see what was happening. I can't say that I've gone back and re-looked at everything that has happening in 2004.
Yeah,
I do know that
try, this coup.
After 2004, Yushchenko, who won that election, made a point of establishing the rehabilitation of Stepan Bandera and
not
other...
Not the guy that won the election, the guy that won the regime change, right?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the guy that won, the guy that lost the election, but overthrew the guy that won the election with America's help, and by pretending that he'd been poisoned by the KGB and all that crap. In other words, America's guy is the one who rehabilitated.
Right, America's guy, and it's always America's guy. I mean, I think, and I don't know if the Russians released it or not, but that tape, which was never disavowed, of Victoria Nuland, you know, talking to the U.S. ambassador, Jeffrey Piat, in Ukraine about how they were going to install their guy, Yatsenyuk, into office in Ukraine. And, you know, telling him, you know, just how the U.S. was going to install this puppet regime. It's all out there. It's not like it's hidden.
Right.
You know, my piece and the thing that I guess is most disturbing to me isn't even the CIA in a weird way, who's doing what they are kind of meant to do, but the press, yourself obviously excluded, and a handful, really literally a handful of others, and meanwhile just promote U.S. State Department CIA propaganda, revving people up for a potential NATO-Russia war, which would be devastating to the world.
Yep.
It's really quite frightening. It's shocking that more people aren't screaming about it, and I really thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah, no, I'm very happy to have you writing about this, and especially bringing up the context so people can see. And, you know, I'm so obsessed with what's going on in the land formerly known as Iraq right now and Palestine.
Yeah.
I can see why everybody else is distracted, too, but there ain't nothing more important in the whole world than America's relationship with Russia, and that's like a quantifiable scientific objective factual statement right there, assuming premise that humanity must survive. You know, we got to keep our eye on this. And by the way, I wanted to mention here this great footnote that you refer to in your article, Jeff, that ran at The Nation and Foreign Policy in Focus, 7 decades of Nazi collaboration, America's dirty little Ukraine secret. That was just a wealth of information. And people can find that link also in your great article here today at dissenter.firedoglake.com. CIA intervention in Ukraine has been taking place for decades. And thanks very much for your time again on the show, Jeff.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Appreciate it. All right, y'all, that's it for the show. Thanks very much for listening. ScottHorn.org/donate. I sure appreciate y'all's support, and everybody's donated so far. Thanks very much. See you tomorrow.